Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 13th of November. This hour, we pay tribute to Studs Terkel. Studs Terkel once said of Leonard Bernstein, to talk with him was an adventure. And the same could be said about talking with Studs Terkel, whose life we will honor this hour. Studs died on October 31st at the age of 96, and Roger Ebert wrote a lovely memorial to Studs, which appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times. Was he the greatest Chicagoan? I cannot think of another. For me, he represented the joyous, scrappy, liberal, generous, wisecracking heart of this city. If you met him, he was your friend. This happened to the hundreds and hundreds of people he interviewed for his radio show and 20 best-selling books. He wrote down the oral histories of those of his time who did not have a voice. In conversation, he could draw up every single one of their names. He was unconditionally open to the world. During the course of this hour, we'll hear some past interviews we were privileged to conduct. Studs talks about Leonard Bernstein, Woody Guthrie, jazz, the blues, Bob Dylan, Mahalia Jackson, and Hope. We had the honor of meeting at his house, my husband Mike, my brother Bob, and I, in December 3 years ago, and I felt as though we were just listening to an incredible man who knew so much about history. He remembered all the players on baseball teams from many years ago. He told the story of trying to get in the FBI. He applied for the FBI, but Herbert Hoover turned him down. What a different life he may have had, huh? And he told the story of making an anti-Semitic comment in the process, Herbert Hoover, that is. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, TV pioneer on Studs Place, theatrical actor, radio host for 45 years. He was blacklisted and credited that for his future prominence as a writer. His first work was Division Street, America, in 1966, and his last book, P.S., Further Thoughts from a Lifetime of Listening, was published the Monday after his death. In 1980, Studs said, if there's something I want to do, it's create a sense of continuity, that there is a past and a present, and that there may be a future, and that there isn't any present unless you know the past. Calvin Trillin will be joining us this hour. He and Studs were great friends who did a television show for a while together. Calvin, of course, another terrific writer who has been writing for The New Yorker since 1963 and also has written for The Nation magazine and has written many books. Calvin will be joining us. We'll hear from some of those shows that I had with Studs Terkel some years ago, actually when he was in his 90s and sharp as could be. And we also welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or you may want to pay a written tribute to Studs, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, wpr.org. One of his books was Hope Dies Last, one of my favorite books. And 3 years ago, the day after the Chicago White Sox won the World Series, which is a pretty big deal in Chicago, and to those of us who grew up in Chicago, I had a chance to speak with Studs about Hope.
Studs, hello.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you, Studs. Delightful being with you again, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's
been a number of years since then.
Yeah, it's
one or two things have happened, but here we are back at the old fan.
Here we are, and the White Sox won the World Series last night.
That proves anything possible.
Yeah,
it is. It's a matter of hope, which even dealing with, say, a comic event, it is sort of a comic event, too, White Sox winning the World Series, even that, you see, the aspect of hope isn't essential. It's easy to be a cynic. There's no point in going on. Well, there's no point in going on unless you have that feeling. And I've been listening to some of the voices of your listeners, and all of them have that one feeling of being had. You know, there's more intelligence in them than they're given credit for by the political big boys who run things. We need not name them, we know, as do the people who call you. And in them, as they ask these questions, you sense this intelligence and this hope and this need and this right to know. So basically, you want to romanticize the White Sox winning the World Series, go ahead.
Well, there's also something about the team, and I think Jesse Jackson made reference to this. Maybe I'm making too much of it, but there's something really American about that team. You know, we got players from Venezuela, we got Latin managers and African-American, you know, managers or whatever their positions are, and everybody's sort of playing for the good of the team. There's something inspiring about it.
You see, you're hitting something that a number of writers have hit. More and more, the multicultural nature of all societies. Mm-hmm. And we are part of the world. We are not an exceptional people. We, too, are a multicultural society. And 9/11, tragic and barbaric though it was, made it clear to us that we are part of the world and not removed from it. And thus, this multiculture is great, provided people understand one another. But we also live in the world of runaway technology. I'm here talking to you right now, Kathleen, because I was saved by technology. Mm-hmm. I had a 93-year-old bad valve, heart valve, about 6 weeks ago, removed. I'm the oldest one, I think, who's had that. Well, I'm here because of the technology, as well as the skilled hands of the surgeon. My two brothers and my father all died in the 50s. Mm. We are genetically angina pectora victims. I should have died at 50, but this machinery has kept me going. Mm-hmm. Now, the same species, human species, that invented that machinery that more and more is helping people through diseases hitherto unsolved are the ones who invented the machine that dropped it on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and repeated it on Nagasaki, August 9, 1945, and it killed a couple of hundred thousand people. Yeah. So the same species can do horrendous things as well as quite remarkable things.
Studs Terkel, in an interview we did 3 years ago. Calvin Trillin is joining us now. Calvin wrote a wonderful piece in The Nation in celebration of Studs Terkel's 95th birthday. He was on Studs' show many times and would go out to lunch with him afterward, and they did a television show together, which we'll ask Calvin to talk about. Calvin, of course, has been writing for The New Yorker since 1963. He's also written for The Nation magazine. He's written many collection of short stories and some wonderful books, including Travels with Alice, Oblivious on He Sails, The Bush Administration in Rhyme, A Heck of a Job, More of the Bush Administration in Rhyme, About Alice, and a number of other books, and is here to talk about Studs. And we'll welcome phone calls during this hour as well. Calvin, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I love the column that you wrote. His accomplishments as America's preeminent listener are all the more remarkable when you consider he happens to be a prodigious talker. He was a talker, wasn't he? And so fascinating to listen to.
Yeah, he could. I said in that piece that considering the sort of talker he was, that being the preeminent listener in the world was he was a monument to restraint. That he actually shut up and listened to those people. He was a great storyteller. He could tell a lot of stories about the rooming house or hotel that his mother ran in Chicago, and a lot of stories about the early days of his career in radio as a villain. He always said he was the guy who said, "Get in there," putting the victim into the closet. And I believe he played in Boston Blackie. And he was one of the few people who actually had funny stories about the blacklist. And he had a lot of Chicago stories, of course. He was pure Chicago.
Yeah. Tell me about the show the two of you did called Nightcap.
Well, it was kind of an odd show. It came about because Studs and I don't know, I guess we were on a panel together at, I think The Nation had some sort of conference, and there was an overflow crowd, so we were sent over to some union hall to have a panel discussion, or maybe it was just a discussion between the two of us. I can't remember. And somebody suggested that we do a television show together. He came up with the idea of doing a conversation on the arts. This I think it was a precursor of A&E. It wasn't A&E. It was something else. But I know it was partly owned by ABC, and this was the very early days of television. I think that when we did that program, Chicago didn't even have cable television. It's sort of hard to figure out who to bribe in Chicago, so it had taken them longer to get cable television than anybody else. And in New York, the best-known show was a show, a guy, I think his name was Ugly George, went around town asking women to bare their breasts for the cameras. So it was a kind of not a very elevated medium at that time. And Studs and I, Studs would fly in from Chicago, and we would tape two or three of these things in a day. And they were supposed to be conversations rather than interviews. And we would have maybe three opera divas or three architects or three people talking about novels being made into movies or three musical comedy people. And Studs, of course, always knew the people. I'm not sure we had anybody on that hadn't seen Studs in Chicago at some point. I always told him it used to be when you went to Chicago, they'd take you to see the Stockyards, but when the Stockyards left, they'd take you to see Studs. So he knew everybody. And at one point, somebody on the program mentioned Jane Austen, and I said, if she ever went through Chicago, Studs knows her. We had a good time doing it. He had to do the real sort of hosting part of it. I never had any idea what time it was or when we should say goodnight or anything like that, but Studs had some sixth sense, I guess, from all those years of doing radio and things that I always told him that if he was on somebody's talking to somebody on a person's deathbed and suddenly some light went on somewhere, he would just turn around for a second and say, good night, see you next week, and then turn back, listen to what the guy had to say. He was very good at that. And so we had a good time. It was a lively show, and of course, Studs always made it easy for anybody to talk and tell stories.
I so much wish I could ask him, Calvin, so what happens next? What's the life after? He was so darn curious about everything and wrote that marvelous book about death, which has helped me through some deaths in my lifetime. And I want him to talk to me about it.
Yeah, well, I think people assume that he's out there interviewing people right now.
Right.
Finding out.
Right. The other thing, and he spoke so eloquently and elevated, as he called the et ceteras of history. I remember his talking about this woman that he had met some 30 years ago at a public housing project. I'm sure you know that story as well. The young mother who was hearing herself for the first time in a tape recorder and said, I never knew I felt that way. And then he said, such astonishments have always been forthcoming from the et ceteras of history ever since the year one. And he sure did elevate them.
He did. He was on his radio show. He interviewed so many well-known people that you sort of forgot that what his real gift was bringing out that sort of comment from ordinary people, and that's really his life's work. And in a way, the interviewing well-known people who came through Chicago was just a way of getting to the other. I think, and Studs was such a generous-hearted person, he always said that Andre Schifrin at Pantheon got him to do the books at the beginning from listening to the show and thinking he could interview anybody. And it is true that he could interview anybody, and I've said over the years that on book tours used to stop at Chicago more than they do now, partly because Studs' show. And you'd get in there sort of dragging after repeating the same thing from your book for program after program till it sounded completely lame. And then you'd get on Studs' show, and he'd had everything underlined in this very broad black, I guess it was one of those Sharpie pens. And And he'd say, hey, read this, or he would read it. And you'd sit back and think, that's really not half bad. No. I suggested, I think, in that piece that instead of spending all this money sending American writers, you know, to villas in Italy to buck them up and everything, all you'd have to do is have them interviewed by studs. You wouldn't even have to air it. All you had to do was just have them sit there. But then when we go out to lunch afterwards and we get in the cab driver always knew him. And he somehow knew the cab driver's neighborhood very well. And over the years, that sometimes changed from back of the yards to maybe Nigeria or someplace like that. But Studs had either been there or a Nigerian had been brought to see him when he came to Chicago. And he always had something to talk about with the cab drivers. And it always was a reminder to me that even though he may have interviewed, you know, Bertrand Russell and Leonard Bernstein, et cetera, that his real gift was interviewing ordinary people.
Right. And he did have this. I love that story you tell of he had read your book and underlined things. He had this generous heart, so he made you feel so good about what you did. I was always elevated whenever I talked to Studs. He made me feel like the work that I was doing was important, and I wasn't half bad at it. And I don't think about that very much, but he made me want to carry on.
Yeah, he had that effect on people, and he had no guile in me. He didn't. I was astonished to read a really warped piece in the New York Times that interpreted this body of work as some Marxist plot of Studs to influence people. It was based mainly on the idea that in the book Working, he presents work as not always such a lot of fun. And that's really the opposite of who he was. He didn't have any, I mean, his politics certainly were there. I remember going more than once to this bar he loved, Ricardo's. I don't know if it's still around, but there was a waiter there who was a Spanish immigrant from the Loyalist days in the war, and I can't remember what the cue was, but at some point he would stroll over to the table and he and Studs would sing Los Cuatro Generales, one of the great Spanish Civil War songs. He never made any secret of his politics, but I don't think that's really what infused his work. What it was this generosity of spirit. He was actually interested in what the people said. You can't really fake that. If you're not interested, it doesn't work.
Right. Calvin Trillin is joining us as we pay tribute to the life of Studs Terkel, who died just a couple weeks ago at the age of 96. We're going to hear a portion of an interview that he did with Leonard Bernstein. He didn't do the interview. It was when I talked to him about his interview with Bernstein, and actually that interview, because of that interview, he came up with the title of one of his books. We'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to send a note to us, we'd love to hear it, is talk@wpr.org. Calvin Trillin, a longtime writer for The New Yorker. He started writing in 1963, also has written for The Nation magazine and has written some marvelous books. We've had the honor to interview him on those as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're honoring the life of the marvelous Studs Terkel this hour of our program. This is from an interview that we did a couple of years ago on his most recent book, in which he had done interviews with people in the music field from all different kinds of music. And this is what he had to say about Leonard Bernstein.
You see, I'm so happy you mentioned Bernstein. That interview with him was, I had to cut it, but I hope I saved the heart of it. That interview with him was full of such generosity of spirit.
Yeah,
he spoke about the man he admired so much, Mark Blitzstein,
mm-hmm.
who wrote that very controversial WPA folk opera, The Cradle of Rock, at the movie Tim Robbins made. But mostly the title comes from him. And they all sang. The subtitle is Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. Because Bernstein said way back, he's not opposed to technology. He believes in everything that helps men and women enrich their lives. But with more and more technology, there's less contact with the human voice. He says, and they all sang. That's his quote. He says, in the olden days, everybody sang. He expected to sing as well as talk. It was a mark of the cultured man or woman to sing, to know music. And so my hearing isn't very good. I assume that was part of West Side Story.
Yes, it was, Studs.
Yeah, I assume that. You realize he could write almost anything.
Yeah.
He sort of helped revolutionize musical comedy. It's not. It's more than that. Or Candide. But isn't that? It's his openness, the humor.
Mm-hmm.
He saw jazz as important. And he said, what would America be like? What would the United States be like? Were there no jazz? Or what would jazz be like if there were no African-American people here? But he would talk about any subject you want. And then I happened to mention The Cradle Will Rock by Mark Blitzstein, a composer he admired very much. And then he starts singing from it. And he says to me, how do you know it? I says, I was in it. I was in a Chicago company. He said, what role? And he guessed I was doing Editor Daily. And we both sang. We both were terrible, of course. But he knew every song from it. His memory. And he also talked about the phony patriotic songs. And what a real song of the American spirit. But the talk with him was sort of an adventure.
To talk with him was sort of an adventure. Oh, you could say that about Studs Terkel. Calvin Trillin is with us. We're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Well, here's another et cetera from history, Kathleen. You should talk about Studs' name because it came from James Farrell's great novel, Studs Lonergan, about a Chicagoan on 61st and Michigan who grew up at St. Anselm's Church. And this wonderful story about this 13-year-old kid growing in the manhood, leaving the eighth grade, the expectations of his life. And I think that Studs Terkel just fell in love with this book. And it's one of the greatest American novels that's not on any reading list on any of the colleges anymore. But I think it's one of the epic novels in the history of American letters.
Would you agree, Calvin?
Yes. I actually read it in college, and it was on the list then, but that was, I'm afraid, a very long time ago when I was in college. I think that's right, that some of the Chicago sort of naturalist writers, like, I don't know if that's the right term for them, but like Farrell and Nelson Algren and everything have been sort of half forgotten, but they were wonderful, and Studs certainly admired that. I think his real name was Lewis, but I think Ida might have called him Lewis.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did.
I remember. I only met Ida a few times, but because I often saw Studs at the station or in New York when we were doing the show, but I think she called him Lewis.
I think her last words as she was being wheeled into surgery were, Lewis, what have you gotten me into? Thanks, John, for the call. Milton from Madison, hi.
First, let me start off by thanking you, Kathleen, for the opportunities I've had to listen to Studs on your program and the opportunity I had to speak with him.
Our pleasure.
Once upon a time. He was a man of slight stature, but to me he was a great giant of a man. I don't think we have anything like him now in our media, and I would think anybody else in the media who's listening right now, if you want somebody to emulate, you could do worse than Studs Terkel.
Calvin?
Yeah, I agree. There's nobody exactly doing what Studs did.
No.
It's not as if he's Hertz and there's an Avis somewhere. I don't think that... that anybody else is doing that sort of thing. It's very difficult what he did. I used to do a piece for the New Yorker around the country every 3 weeks. And I did that for 15 years, and a couple of times I tried doing sort of all quote pieces with a tape recorder, and he may have made it look easy, but it is not easy, because people, as you know, from what you do, don't really talk in perfect paragraphs, and it's a very difficult thing to do, and it's very difficult to draw them out. So I think they're sort of scholarly or historical projects that, like Columbia, I think they still do that as an oral history project. But as far as people doing it and then publishing it, it's very rare. There's a book recently on George Plimpton that's done in that way. But it's the idea of doing it on a subject or like World War II or death or something like that, I think is something that only Studs did.
And do you think he's been credited, I wonder if it's rightfully so, Calvin, for this whole move among historians to look at history from the bottom up?
I don't know enough about history to do that. I did a piece once on the annual meeting of the American Historical Association, or whatever you call it, some years ago, when I think often it's called the new social history, when people, instead of concentrating on the big battles and the presidents, actually look at farm wives' diaries from the pioneer days and that sort of thing. Studs might have had something to do with that, but I think the other thing that might have had something to do with that is more women coming into the profession. And people whose interest wasn't in the big battles or necessarily or who saw a sort of a broader path for of history than just that. So he may have had some influence in there, but I think there were other elements of that.
Studs Terkel had a chance to interview Bob Dylan when he was 22 years old, and this is what he said about Dylan. In 1963, Studs interviewed Bob Dylan, calling him a young folk poet. At the time, he spoke with him, one of the most exciting singers of songs around, rumpled trousers, curly hair, wearing a skipper's cap, 22 years old. He cannot be pigeonholed. And I guess that's true. We're on Bob Dylan now, Studs Terkel. You said he can't be pigeonholed, and he still can't be pigeonholed.
I remember that. He was 22, this young kid, and I remember my first question, where'd you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? Cotton Eye Joe was the beginning of a folk song renaissance, and Burl Ives was singing stuff at Columbia Records, and that was one of them.
Well.
And he came out of his... But he told about this one song at the time that I thought was his great song. This is, remember now, he's 22 years old. How many years ago was that? 62?
He's 63 now, I think, yeah.
Yeah, my arithmetic is terrible. But it's The Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And he wrote that song way back, and I said to myself, my God, this is a fantastic song.
Mm.
But I misinterpreted it. I said hard rain, and I was referring to atomic rain.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, he meant something beyond that. He says, someone else said the same thing to him, asked him, is this about atomic rain? No, it was part of it. He says, it's the rain. What is going to happen to us? And now we come to the year 2005, and I'm 93. And we know the world at the moment is all bollocksed up, and you wonder what is going to happen to the human race when there is no leadership anywhere, it seems, that has any sanity to it, you see. And so the song, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, he explains it bit by bit. And he says, and each line could be a folk song in itself.
Mm.
And so that was a very exciting interview.
Yeah.
Coming across it. But you know who his great influence was?
Woody Guthrie.
You betcha.
Yeah.
He says, Woody at the time was very ill. And he was my guest at the house a number of times. When he was with that group way back, I didn't finish my thought, way back. The group called the Almanac Singers.
Mm.
and they preceded the Weavers, and they sang at rallies when the CIO was being formed, at the steelworkers rallies, at the packing house workers, farm equipment workers, and they traveled. So was Woody Guthrie and his young kid Pete Seeger, and Lee Hayes, a big heavy guy from Arkansas, and a young writer named Millard Lampell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but Woody was Bob Dylan's inspiration at the beginning.
Studs Terkel, we honor his life this hour of our program. Calvin Trillin is with us. And Calvin, you can get this online. You may want to read Calvin's tribute to Studs on his 95th birthday. And it was written May 10, The Nation. Calvin, a pal of Studs Terkel, and they even did a television show together, which Calvin told us about. Let's go back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Roxanne from Menominee is next. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi. Say, I'm a retired flight attendant, and I started flying in 1970.
Can you speak up a little bit, Roxanne?
Yes. I'm a retired flight attendant, and I started flying in 1972 out of Chicago, where I was acquainted then with Mr. Terkel and his work. And one day I had Della Reese on my flight, and she was coming in to play at Mr. Kelly's to perform there. And she invited us to come down, and we sat in the audience, and Studs Terkel was in the audience, and she introduced him. So it was great to see the face with the name. But a few years, I left Chicago and traveled all over and forgot my interest in Studs until a few years ago I came across the tapes, Voices of Time, 5 decades of Studs Terkel interviews. And they're marvelous, and I just love them, and I think they're still so poignant today, and every time I listen to them, I end up taking notes because it just opens a whole world of other interests that I would like to pursue. So it was like finding an old friend when I found those tapes, and I just thought I'd share that.
Oh, those are great to have.
I should say I was reminded by the reference to Bob Dylan, who I actually saw just in his performance at Gertie's Folk City just before that interview, I think. I think Gertie's Folk City was his first New York appearance. And I went with a man who had become a real folk purist. And he went mainly to sneer at Bob Dylan. He said he's just a Woody Guthrie knockoff. I don't think we had the word knockoff then, but whatever the equivalent was. It's interesting that Studs sort of celebrated that. I mean, it's sort of his enthusiasm that, of course, Woody Allen was his inspiration. But I think if you went on Studs' show, one of the interesting things and one of the things that did make you feel he was taking what you wrote seriously was that he had spent a lot of time picking out the right music to introduce you. When the show came on, he played, and not a whole song, but some bars of the song, and sometimes he would say before the interview, well, you know, I thought of leading with such and such, but I decided, no, this book would be more like that. And you could see that with great nuance, he had decided what the most appropriate music would be.
Oh, what a nice thing to do, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of writers walked out of that studio a little taller than they had walked
right.
in.
Right.
By the way, I'm glad she mentioned that. It may be on CD, but I have it on cassette. It's a wonderful series of interviews that Studs did. It's about, I think the one I have, it's a little box set. It's about 5 cassettes, and it's a great thing for listening in the car.
Yes. Calvin, thank you so much for being with us. It's an honor to speak with you always as well, and it's fitting that the two of you would have been buddies.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Calvin Trillin, and I would highly recommend that you go to The Nation to his tribute to Studs Terkel on his 95th birthday last year. It's the May 10, 2007 Nation article, The Nation, and Calvin Trillin played tribute to the oral historian and great friend of the nation, who died on October 31st of this year at the age of 96. We're welcoming more phone calls. We'll hear some more interview with Studs when he talks about jazz and on living a rich, full life. So all of that's coming up, plus more of your phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk about the rich, long life of Studs Terkel this hour of our program from an interview we did a couple years ago. This is Studs on jazz.
My last transfer before coming to the university was the black belt, known as Bronzeville. And from while waiting for the other streetcar, I'd hear this music coming out of stores, not just music stores, but all kinds of shops, gallimaufry shops, meaning selling everything. And I hear these records, sometimes with Big Bill Brunsley and Tampa Red and Memphis Minnie and Roosevelt Sykes. And these were country blues singers, but there was something about that music. There was not a cry or a wail. It was an expression of life and a dream. And Big Bill Brunsley was one of my favorites. I think he's the one little known. Hmm. Most people know Muddy Waters. Muddy was a disciple of Big Bill Brunsley. Hmm. As so many of those who respect him, I don't put them down. They're wonderful. But Bill, and that's when I first heard Big Bill Brunsley, and he became my friend for many years.
Yes.
But hearing that music, almost by accident, I would hear jazz. And it's spoken of the same way. My brother, my older brother, was sort of a dancer. He was a shoe dog. He worked as a shoe salesman, department store. And they had this ballroom that a working class would attend. You know, file clerks and stenographers and guys who were shoe salesmen and other things. And the bands were always black, but the patrons were white. Segregation, of course. Patty Harmon's Dreamland Ballroom. So I loved my brother, and I'd follow him around. And he'd say, "Then you go home now." He wants to have some good luck and pick somebody up. If he's very lucky, he'd find a nurse. And that was the height. He was sort of a precocious Don Giovanni. And so he'd bribe me to go home because he'd buy me a chocolate mullet with ginger snaps. But that's when I first heard jazz.
Maybe that's what we should have in honor of Studs today, a chocolate malt and some ginger snaps. Let's go to more phone calls. Al from Ladysmith. Hi, Al.
Hi.
Hi.
I met Studs Terkel in about 1980 after I'd been introduced to Wallace Kirkland, a retired life photographer, and Studs had interviewed him. So he knew Kirk.
Hmm.
And so when I went to see him at his radio station, I was already kind of semi-acquainted with him. And at that time, I had about 5 back page spreads in Chicago Tribune in about 6 months or so, and he recognized my name.
Hmm.
But I was a stringer for Time Magazine at the time also. But when I was teaching over here, I'm living in Ladysmith right now, but I was teaching at Mount Scenario College, and I was publishing the Academy of Arts, Sciences, and Letters. And it was about 15 photographs. So I called Studs up at his radio station, and I asked him permission because to use a quote that he used in Division Street, which was, "Artist with a compassionate eye."
Mm.
And he said, "Oh, yeah, go ahead. So I used that in the biography about my life and stuff. But I was raised in Chicago. I was born on the west side of Chicago. And every time I would go see him at his radio station, I brought him a book to autograph. And there's one, The Great Divide. He said, "Here's to your greatness and generosity of spirit. Wish there were more of like you."
Uh-huh.
All of my warmest. And then he wrote, "Here's to all the grace and beauty and all those great faces you've captured," a book called Race. So that was kind of my, that was my uh, int- introduction to Scott.
And he made you feel taller, as Calvin Trillin said, too, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah, he could do that. He could do that.
He was an outstanding guy. Outstanding.
Yes, he was. Thank you so much for the call, Al.
Okay.
Yeah, we had a chance to interview Studs on several occasions, and this is Studs on, you know, we were interviewing when he was 93 years old and 95 years old. This is an interview, part of just a clip of an interview that we did with him, on, and he talked about his long and very rich life.
A prophetic minority, a prescient minority, mm-hmm. always those who've spoken out and have more than paid their dues, whether they be abolitionists during slavery days, whether they be Thomas Paine, the beginning, he's my hero as a journalist, Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense, more than that. In fact, he set the pattern. We think of him today and the violation of his memory, because he said Americanism involves the right to speak out and to say no, for a cat can look at a king, and an ordinary person, so-called, can look at a president and can tell him, if he disagrees with him, to bugger off. And that's the first country ever, ever to have had that principle. Mm-hmm. And he thought of us as the country that would set the pattern for the rest of the world. So I've been pretty lucky in running into or coming across the writings of different ones. So.
Well, we've been very lucky to have you, and I mean that really most sincerely. You're a wonderful guy.
Nah.
You are.
Pain in the butt. but I do like artists who connect their art with their life, and whether that artist be a carpenter or a tool and die maker or a woman who scrubs the floors.
Yeah.
Who is somehow or other has that dream of a full, rich life, that dream for her kids, if not for herself. And this has always been the case. And so I think one way or another, with or without me, the human race will make it.
Yeah.
So Mark Twain called us the damn human race.
Let's go back to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tom from Sheboygan, hi.
Good morning. I also would like to thank you for the opportunity to talk to Studs about old-time blues on one of your shows.
You're very welcome.
The reason I'm calling is, isn't it ironic that back in the 50s, great Americans like Paul Robeson, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Lillian Hillman, and Studs being investigated by the House on Committee on Un-American Activities. The greatest Americans of the 20th century were being subjected to a witch hunt by these small minds in Washington. I think that history is going to, and already has, shown that the un-American individuals were the ones that were banging the gavels and putting people in prison and destroying people's lives back then. That was about it. I wanted to mention that. I admired Studs greatly.
Thank you, Tom, very much for the call. He tells the story in so many of his books and in person about Mahalia Jackson, and he had lost his radio show because of his supposed political beliefs being not American. He was to introduce her at a concert in Chicago, and somebody from NBC, I believe, came up to him and said, "You can't do this. You are not allowed on the air." And Mahalia Jackson stood up for him and said that if he wasn't going to do the introduction, then she wasn't going to sing. And they were great friends. We're going to end the show in a few moments with a wonderful Mahalia Jackson piece. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Kathy from Pewaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Such an interesting program. I met Studs Terkel in, I think it was 1976. He had come to Manchester College in North Manchester, Indiana, as part of the speakers series, and at a they had kind of a talk back after his main presentation, and He just kind of chatted with people, and he elicited from me, I guess, that I had just been elected to the town council as a Democrat and as a female in a town that was very strongly Republican. And he started asking about how I had done that and what I had done and everything. And it was really, really fascinating how he could just he could make you feel like you were so interesting because he
right.
was so interested.
Right, right.
And, you know, I know I never made it into any of the books, but it was just such an experience to have someone be so focused on you. And there was a whole room of people that were there, and I think he did that with everyone he talked to, that he could just make you feel like you were the only person there.
Yes, he did. I love what he talked about as wanting to have as his epitaph, that curiosity never killed this cat. Thank you, Kathy, so much for your call. Let's go to Shell from a cell phone. Hi, Shell.
Yes, I'm curious if Mr. Turkle had children, and if he does, do they write?
He has a son named Dan, and Dan has been caring for Studs because he's had a series of health problems the past few years. He also teaches, I believe, and I'm not sure if he does very much writing, but maybe he will now.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. Dorothy from Waupaca, hi.
Hey, Darla, are you speaking to me?
Yes, I am, Dorothy.
I knew the Studs. I went to summer school with him and his wife when headmasters from England came to tell us how their teaching has changed in England since the war. And I invited him to my classroom, and he came, and he you see, my husband had started educational television in the East Wing of Science and Industry in Chicago.
Sure.
And I knew him that way. But he came to my classroom and he walked in and he said, "The roofs of Ghana." And I said, "Of course. This student is from Ghana, and she draws beautifully." And I said, "Take them with you. She will make more for me because she loves to draw, and we draw all the time." And I shall never forget his wonderful attitude.
Right, that's what he had. He had a wonderful attitude. We're all going to miss him. I always so looked forward to the interviews that we had with Studs Terkel, and we were privileged to have several over the past few years. Studs Terkel, celebration of his life, his long life. He died at the age of 96 on October 31st. And here's Mahalia.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired. take my hand. Precious Lord, and